This is a paper by Ronald Klette entitled God is All. Ronald Klette was a South African Christian science practitioner, and the work was probably written in the 1980s. In the beginning, God. These are the first four words in the Bible, and a good beginning to this address, and to everything we do. Understood, they are the solution to all the world's problems. Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, and the author of its textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scripture, writes, "The infinite has no beginning. This word beginning is employed to signify the only, that is, the eternal verity and unity of God and man, including the universe." Indeed, I would say that the first four words and the last word in the Bible embrace the whole of the Bible and science and health. In the beginning, God. Amen. Just like that. That is all we need to know. Just think of it. Just God. Nothing but God. Only God. Infinite God and nothing else. When was something added to this all God? And when added, where did it come from? When was anything taken away from this all God? And when taken away, where was it placed, this bit of God that was taken away? Silly questions to begin with, aren't they? But how many of us believe that these things have happened and are happening many times in the course of our daily rounds? I have a friend who in the past has left me quite frustrated on many occasions by her refusal to talk about anything but God. Her reason, I can assure you, is a very good one. She says there is nothing else to talk about. I used to get quite annoyed with her, but gradually over a period of years, I have arrived at the conclusion that she is right. What else is there to talk about? Is there God and something else? I won't ask you to answer that question to me, just answer it for yourselves. Here, I believe I can do no better than quote from Mrs. Eddy, "Answer at once and practically and answer aright," quote from Miscellaneous Writings. The answer can leave no room whatever for manoeuvring or compromising or sidestepping. It throws a challenge right at us. It forbids us to say or think any ifs or buts. It is so or it isn't. What do you say? Remember, before you answer, there can be no compromise. There isn't God and something else. Is there anything else at all? A wonderful word, that very small word, is. It can only be applied to God. If God is, and he is, then anything else is not. Now take this into your thought and think it over carefully. Just think of it. Only infinite mind to think as. God is your mind. Then you don't think about mind. Think as mind. Just spirit to deal in. No matter to move in or about. Just a permanent residence in soul, which is God. No soul living in your body, ready to fly away at any moment to some place called heaven, or the other place. Don't many of us still feel that we may be going someplace someday? Just a great infinite principle, which is forever conscious of us, and with which we are one, without any effort or struggle on our part. A life which is eternal now and ever present, and which is such pure life that there is not even the tiniest taint of death in it. No death day to worry about. But no birthday to celebrate either. Just a wonderful truth, which is actually everywhere, and is everything that is. And could truth be anything but pure good? A truth that, even if we catch a glimmer of it, establishes itself in our experience effortlessly by its own irresistible power and presence. Said Jesus, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." How about love? In Miscellaneous Writings, Mrs. Eddy said, "What a word! I am in awe before it. Over what worlds on worlds it hath range and is sovereign, the underived, the incomparable, the infinite all of good, the alone God is love." Do we have doubts that God is love? Could the one and only Creator take a dislike to his own creation, to himself, and begin to hate it? It is true that what is not pure love is hate, for only absolute purity applies to God. My very first experience of what the realization of the allness of God can do occurred at the beginning of my work as a Christian Science practitioner. I was sitting with some trepidation waiting for my phone to ring for the first time. When it did, I nearly fell off my chair. It was a call from a complete stranger who could hardly speak and was apparently completely incapacitated by vomiting and pains in the head. After hanging up the phone, I frankly had to admit that I was by then in no mental condition to give a treatment. But not knowing what else I could do, I began to pace up and down the floor by declaring out loud the absolute allness of God and the nothingness of any kind of sickness. I said to the world at large, "I refuse to accept anything in any direction whatsoever that contradicts the allness and the goodness of God." All this was done at the top of my voice while pacing up and down the floor. Every time any suggestion of the error tried to enter my consciousness, I rejected it and almost shouted the totality of God. I was far from calm, but I persisted in rejecting the error and declaring the allness of God. After 20 minutes of this, I could not go on any more, but later in the day, the patient phoned to say that she had been healed and had spent the day doing all sorts of things she had not been able to do for a long time. It's only right to mention here that this was not the end of the problem. This illness had been troubling the patient for years, and although she had had much help in science, only temporary relief had been experienced. She'd been completely floored every 3 or 4 days, living in fear of the attacks, and was quite desperate with it all. But the sudden attack on the error this time, with the vigorous declaration of the allness of God, had broken the mesmerism, and within about 3 months she was completely healed. Now, there were several things to be learned from this healing. No matter what state of mind one appears to be in, God is always available. His help is never withheld. We should never say that we can't give a treatment because we are not in the right frame of mind. We don't do the work. Truth does. And this was positive proof of that. Also, no matter what the circumstance, God is always all. We just have to declare it and realize it. Whether we feel responsible or not, whether we are afraid or not, God still does the work. And the results will always give us confidence. If we can't appeal to God because we are told we're not in the right frame of mind, or because we feel afraid, and I know that there are those who would lead us to believe that we can't expect a healing until we get rid of the fear, then how will we ever get in touch with God? We have to get in touch with God before we can get rid of the fear. Go forward, never mind the obstacles. Trip over them, fall over them, but go forward, whether you are up or down. I have, of course, never forgotten this experience. And basically, I still believe it is the right way to give a treatment. Although I'm happy to tell you that I don't make so much noise about it anymore. Subheading, God, there is none else. Isaiah writes, I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know thee from the rising from the sun and from the west, that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens and made it, he established it. He created it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Tell ye, and bring them near, yea, let them take counsel together. Who hath declared this from ancient time? Who hath told it from that time? Have not I the Lord? And there is no God else beside me, a just God and a Saviour. There is none beside me. Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth. For I am God, and there is none else. I quote at length because Isaiah was a prophet in close touch with his Maker at all times, and his use of the terms I am and there is none else with such absolute assurance is fraught with meaning. It is obvious that when giving a treatment, Isaiah was in the habit of listening for God's voice and allowing the spiritual sense of the Almighty declaring himself to do the work for him. When God spake to him, Isaiah heard God saying, I am. Isaiah simply repeated to the Israelites God's words as they came to him and as he actually heard them. In this attitude of listening and hearing God declare himself, Isaiah must have been absolutely conscious of his unity, his oneness with God, so much so that any sense of material selfhood, that false sense that claims we are a separate entity from God, must have been completely eliminated, made to retire to its own background of nothingness. You know that false sense that says there is a God, but here I am. Isaiah knew that God was his selfhood, his actual mind. He knew that the only thoughts that could come to him had to come from his mind. He knew he couldn't tell God anything, for as Mrs. Eddy so clearly saw, the intercommunication is always from God to his idea man. So he listened and he heard. He obeyed the instruction of the Christ to enter into the closet. And when thou hast shut the door, pray to thy Father which is in secret. In other words, he consulted his mind. In the textbook, Mrs. Eddy says, the closet typifies the sanctuary of spirit, the door of which shuts out sinful sense, but lets in truth, life, and love. Closed to error, it is open to truth, and vice versa. Further on, Mrs. Eddy continues, in order to pray aright, we must enter into the closet and shut the door. We must close the lips and silence the material senses. In the quiet sanctuary of earnest longings, we must deny sin and plead God's allness. There really is no reason why we should not obey these instructions. There is nothing to prevent it. And by this I mean there is nothing that seems to be preventing us. If we obey these instructions, they become the door to quick healings. I know, I have experienced it when I have been obedient. I know it requires tremendous self-discipline. It requires time. Perhaps it requires getting up at 5:30 on a cold winter's morning, even before the sparrows wake up, to study and pray in Christian science before commencing the day's chores. Maybe it will mean sacrificing some of those evening outings which mean so much to us. But putting God first is not impossible. And we are all going to have to do it sooner or later, even if it is a couple of hundred years hence. Have you ever heard God say, when the senses have stopped clamoring, all desires have been stilled, and deep down within you all is quiet and peaceful, and you are able to listen? Have you ever heard God say, I am? It is an experience you will never forget. I am sure you have had it, and you know it can be repeated. Once, not long ago, while I was in this listening and hearing attitude, a dying child in a hospital was raised to life. I never set eyes on that child, a 2-year-old boy, but I spoke to him over the telephone 2 or 3 days after treatment began and heard him making gurgling, happy baby noises. I have since been told that whereas he was a weakling and delicate, today he is flourishing. This is only one of the lights shining in the darkness. Jesus was able to turn to God at will. In fact, he must have been in a continual state of communion with God. Often on his daily rounds, he must have asked God, "What do you say, Father?" and listened for the answer, as Mrs. Eddy did, and heard God say, "I am all," then rested content in this knowledge, leaving all sense of responsibility on God's shoulders, where it belongs anyway. Jesus said, "Having ears, hear ye not?" It has been asked of me more than once, how can I keep my thoughts on God all day and all night? I would be very shortly bored stiff, or words to that effect. My reply invariably has been, considering the fact that God is all in all, what else do you think you can think about, since God is all there is? To quiet the senses to such an extent that one can settle down and listen for and actually hear the voice of God declaring his omnipresence, omnipotence and omniscience, is by far the most effective form of treatment that can be experienced. We can all tune in to God and stay tuned. We can tune out the other stations and hear that wonderful call sign, I am, and then we can cast out all fear and doubt and say, God is. Subheading, God is action. That God is good we take for granted. Mrs. Eddy, among other things, tells us that God is omni-action. God is an ever-active God. He could not be God if he were not always actively being what he is. We are too inclined to think of God as a dormant sort of good, but not really doing anything about it. I think you can see that if good is not actively good, then it cannot be anything at all. We read in Science and Health, mind is the source, of all movement, and there is no inertia to retard or check its perpetual and harmonious action. One dictionary meaning of the word inertia is matter. To realize this is a very good form of treatment for apathy. Mrs. Eddy always says, God rests in action. Why should we not then feel rested by action instead of feeling tired, as is generally accepted as being natural? There is no good reason why anyone should ever feel tired. There is no law that God ever made that says it must be so. Did you know that it is a sin for a Christian scientist to say, I am tired? For I am is God, and God does not feel tired. This is only another instance of the carnal mind's subtle reversals of the truth. Subheading, Is God Absent? Mrs. Eddy states in Science and Health, We are sometimes led to believe that darkness is as real as light. But science affirms darkness to be only a mortal sense of the absence of light, at the coming of which darkness loses the appearance of reality. So sin and sorrow, disease and death are the suppositional absence of life, God, and flee as phantoms of error before truth and love. Mrs. Eddy makes plain throughout all her writings that sin, sickness and death are unreal. But the question is often asked, if they are unreal, if they are a lie, how did we ever become acquainted with them? How do they appear to have such clearly defined characteristics? The different types of sin, the myriad forms of disease, and the many phases of death, which seemingly can be accurately catalogued and accurately identified, and which are continually being added to. Of course, the right answer to that question is that we have never really become acquainted with them. Mrs. Eddy says that material sense is an enigma. It cannot be explained. She tells us in the textbook, we reason imperfectly from effect to cause when we conclude that matter is the effect of spirit. But a priori reasoning shows that material existence to be enigmatical. Spirit gives the true mental idea. We cannot interpret spirit mind through matter. Nevertheless, let me attempt an explanation. Mrs. Eddy groups all these things together and classifies them under the heading of error. Anything that causes inharmony or distress in any form, we can easily identify as error. But many forms of error are not so easily identified, especially when they appear to give us pleasure and comfort. Hence Jesus' admonition, And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Once we have identified error as error, we can set about dealing with it. Mrs. Eddy's statement that error is the opposite of truth, and that truth being reality, error must of necessity be unreal, hardly needs any amplification. Truth is something, error is nothing. Everything that is truth or true is the manifestation of truth and is real and clearly identified as idea. In the textbook, Mrs. Eddy says of these ideas, Spirit names and blesses all. Without natures particularly defined, objects and subjects would be obscure, and creation would be full of nameless offspring, wanderers from the parent mind, strangers in a tangled wilderness. Mortal mind or error, the opposite of truth, cannot make its own arrangements or define its own ideas. It has to copy, as best it can, that which already exists, that which is actual. The textbook tells us thought is borrowed from a higher source than matter, and by reversal, errors serve as waymarks to the one mind, in which all error disappears in celestial truth. And so it is that error or nothing, being the opposite or the reversal of truth, and the opposite of each and every clearly defined idea which constitutes truth, seems to appear as some form of clearly defined material error or nothing. Every error, every disease, every loss of harmony is some gross misinterpretation of some truth, some actuality misseen, some spiritual idea misconceived. Although it never alters truth, it sees truth through the distorted lens of mortal thinking. But bear this firmly in mind, that it is nevertheless looking right at truth and telling us a lie about it, telling us truth is something else. Provided we are clear about this, and we fully realize what we are doing, we can always look right at error, no matter what it seems to be, and say to ourselves, actually, that is God, for there is only God to see. If we do this with clear understanding, we will be looking right through error and seeing God, seeing truth that is actually there, seeing actual truth that we are being told lies about. There is healing in this thought, but we must be careful that we realize that we are not calling error God. We live in the mental atmosphere of the divine mind, but misinterpreted, this atmosphere becomes an environment of mental suggestions which we translate into what appears to be material situations and objects. Nothing is the opposite of something, but nothing is not just empty space. There is no such thing as empty space, there is only God. Any particular form of evil, be it sin, sickness, or death, is merely a belief that God is absent. Naturally, the absence of God being nothing, this particular absence of God appears in a pictured thought form of evil, which is the very opposite of the phase of God which we believe to be absent. If we have to believe a lie, it can never be a lie about nothing. It has to be a lie about something, about that which is real. Of course, God or good is never absent. We only believe he can be, and this belief is manifested to us in some form of evil. God being infinite, the manifestation in human experience of the belief that he is absent seems to be an infinite variety of evil. That is why a clear realization of the omnipresence and omnipotence of God, without any specific denial of a particular form of evil, will simply blot out any evil, no matter what form it takes. Evil is really proof positive that God is real. When Jesus stilled the storm at sea, he knew the presence of God. He knew the carnal mind was telling a lie about the peace of mind, about the quietness and stillness of omnipotence. He knew that God is omni-action, and the storm faded out for lack of presence and action. Good fits itself to any need or situation. So long as we know that it is good that is present, it will always be in the right form to meet that particular need. We need never worry about the details. God always takes care of those. Ignorance of the presence of God is not something, it is nothing. When we get down to thinking in this matter, we will find there is no such thing as an opposite to anything. There are no opposites in creation or reality. You may ask, how do I protect myself against this belief of evil? The best protection against this plague is a thorough conviction that there is nothing to protect oneself against. If we did everything that we were told to do every day for protective work, we would be sitting in a chair doing protective work for ourselves from morning until night, and all night too. Let us be reasonable about this. After all, God is all there is. There cannot be God and some evil presence besides, waiting to pounce on us when we are not looking. If the work done by all Christian scientists throughout the world for the destruction of evil over the last 100 years has been ineffective, then Mrs. Eddy's labours have been in vain. But rest assured, this work has been effective, and much error has been destroyed. It is the impending destruction of all evil that is causing the upheaval in the world today. But bear in mind that Jesus said many years ago, "In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." He did not feel that he had personally to overcome all evil in all the world. He knew that it was sufficient for him to overcome the evil only in his own experience. The realization of your perfection and indestructibility as an idea in mind, and the continual contemplation of the fact that there isn't God and something else, but just God, is your absolute protection from the illusion of evil forces. We do not have to be in a continual state of anticipation of disaster, nor do we have to be in a perpetual state of tension in case we have not done our protective work properly, or in the fear that we have left something out. Once you have done your initial work, your best protection then is to refuse point blank to accept into your consciousness the mass of fear-producing suggestions which are continually presenting themselves to you for acceptance, and refuse to malpractice on your own work. Trust God. Take it easy. I mean in the sense of not allowing yourself to be disturbed. Be happy and joyful, which is fulfilling your purpose in life. And this is your best protection. Study carefully what Mrs. Eddy has given us in this regard on page 211 of Miscellany. Subheading: God incorporeal but not bodiless. The very first thing that Mrs. Eddy found it necessary to point out in her definition of God in the chapter in Science and Health entitled Recapitulation is that God is incorporeal, that is, without a material body. I believe that this is what she meant, for God is not bodiless. Man is the body of God. This word incorporeal is given, no doubt, to counteract the false concept of God as a benevolent-looking, although cranky type of old man sitting on a throne somewhere up in the sky, meting out justice to some and plenty of injustice to others. A God who could be angry with a creation which was so imperfect that it was continually slipping up and doing something wrong and meriting dire punishment such as plagues, sickness and droughts. But of course we know better than that today. We no longer believe in such a God, do we? Let us ask ourselves, have we really gotten down to thinking out what kind of God we actually accept as God? Do we ever say, when we don't feel so good, I wonder what I have done wrong. I must have allowed a wrong thought to creep into my consciousness. Is this not an acknowledgement of a corporeal God with a creation so imperfect that it has slipped up somewhere and so merits punishment? Is not God your consciousness? Would it not have been better to know this right away and refuse to plead guilty to any crime meriting punishment? Our consciousness, which is God, could not possibly be invaded, so there is nothing whatever to be punished or deserving punishment. Man is the body of God, and this is the only permissible way we can think of God as having a body. Man truly is the embodiment of God's thinking, just as your body is surely the embodiment of your thinking. God is unconfined. It would be not out of place here to say a word about the sense of guilt from which so many people appear needlessly to suffer, either because they feel they have done something wrong in the past, or because they feel they should have done something they didn't do. Some people simply feel guilty for no reason at all. Not that there is ever any good reason for feeling guilty. Whatever reason anyone may feel he has for entertaining this false sense, God does not know a thing about it. For what God knows nothing about, he is certainly not going to punish. We arrange our own punishment for everything we do and everything we don't do. This utterly false and unnecessary feeling is one of the prime stoppers to progress spiritward and is a complete waste of time. While you are entertaining a sense of guilt, you can't get on with it. One can never see oneself as the pure image and likeness of God while feeling like some sort of criminal. And if anyone thinks he is anything but the pure image and likeness of God, he should think again that the man that God made is wholly innocent, and there is no other man. This is the way God made him, and he could never be guilty of wrongdoing. You are that man. Claim your innocence. The more you do this, the less likely you are to be prone to wrongdoing. Refuse to entertain a sense of guilt. You can do this. You are entitled to do this. Please do not feel guilty simply because you exist. Because you do exist without any effort on your part, you are fulfilling the purpose for which you exist. All you have to do about this is to be happy about it, and this is doing all you are supposed to do. Subheading: One God and One Idea, Man. There is only one God, and there is only one perfect idea, man. To sense, there appears to be many men, but there is only one idea, man. This statement seems contradictory and puzzling to many, but we can prove it for ourselves by refusing to argue or puzzle over it. If there is, in fact, only God and his idea, man, then don't suffer from a false sense of modesty. Claim, I am that man, and see how wonderfully things work out. You are well aware of the fact that you are very much an entity. Then why should you not personally be that one compound idea, including all right ideas? You are. Don't wait for someone else whom you believe to be a better man or woman to claim it. You claim it now. You are that man. Whatever goes on in our thinking should only be between ourselves and our God. This is where our whole life experience occurs. This thinking should not involve the human sense of people. Get the right idea of our own individual unity with God. Be at peace with God. See that you and I and God are one. Then, when we are thoroughly at one with God, our human sense of people will be a right one and a good one and a continually improving one and will no longer cause us puzzlement and agitation. We will begin to see God in people. It is within, deep down within ourselves, that all healing takes place. But all this healing takes place between you and God. It never involves what we believe to be someone else. Don't let the old liar and father of lies tells you it is someone else, that out there is a situation or a person or lots of persons to be healed. If we accept this suggestion, the healing will not take place, or it will be long delayed. Remember, everything is between you and your God, not between you and another person, not between you and another person, not between you and some outside situation or event, just you and God, in that closet again, with the door closed. Doesn't this take all the complication out of living and praying and working? There is only God to deal with. We always land back with God, don't we? Subheading: Was there ever a time when there was nothing? God is what always has been. This belief that there was a time when there was nothing is also the foundation of the belief that there was a beginning, that God began, rose out of nothing into something somehow or other. When I was a child, I often got to wondering in my search for an answer, if God made me, who made God, and so on, ad infinitum, until I was overcome by a strange empty feeling in my stomach, and I had to abandon my fearful speculations for the time being. Later, Christian Science gave me the answer. The belief that there was a time when there was nothing is the foundation of matter. It arose out of nothing and is nothing. When we are thinking of nothing, we are thinking of matter. And when we are thinking of matter, our thoughts are not occupied at all. It is impossible to make nothing into something. And it is equally impossible to turn something into nothing. Not even God can do this. That is why, if you are really convinced that you do exist, you are eternal. Come to think of it, this is so even if you are not convinced. If you are something, you can never become nothing. What is, what isn't, and never was. Say to yourself daily, with conviction, of course, God is what always has been, and I have coexisted with God throughout all eternity, which is now and only now. I never began, and I can never end. I was never born into matter or into life. I was never born at all. I always have been, so I cannot grow old or decay and die. We read in the textbook, the foundation of mortal discord is a false sense of man's origin. To begin rightly is to end rightly. I'm sure she did not mean there is an actual beginning or an actual end. Subheading: God's body or bodyguard. Very often we are afraid to leave body out of our thought while we know the truth, because we feel perhaps that while we are not looking, something may happen to us. This is a favorite trick of animal magnetism, to keep us from being absent from the body and present with the Lord. As the body is the manifestation of our thinking, nothing but good can happen to it while we are knowing good. I don't mean that we must think good thoughts about the body. The body is our thinking, and we cannot think good thoughts about our thinking, or can we? I will leave you to work that one out. Just think good thoughts, that is all. And when you look again, you will see the body is as good as your thinking has been. Many a healing has taken place when someone has been so wrapped up in a certain line of spiritual reasoning that the body has been completely forgotten. And more often than not, the treatment has not been intended for any specific problem or ailment. This is the advantage of staying one's thought on God, as Paul so aptly described it, being absent from the body and present with the Lord. We don't live because our hearts beat. Our hearts beat because we live. We don't live because our bodies move. Our bodies move because we live. This is why Mrs. Eddy says, there must be a change from the belief that the heart is matter and sustains life, to the understanding that God is our life, that we exist in mind, live thereby, and have being. That's taken from miscellaneous writings. Many people feel that Christian Science aims at robbing them of their bodies, and that it teaches that they will one day be bodiless, some kind of ghost moving aimlessly about in space. It is a fact that our sense of body seems to be very precious to all of us, and we withdraw instinctively from anything that causes us to feel that we may be deprived of our bodies. But we will never be without our bodies, yes, the same ones we have now, but as we advance in understanding, we will take a very different view of them. After all, our view of bodies is what they are. Does this sound somewhat far-fetched? I can assure you that none of us is going to disintegrate or fall apart. And my authority for saying this is from the scriptures. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Further on, it says that God's work was finished, complete. Nothing is going to change. Everything is settled, complete, perfect. It couldn't be otherwise, but our view of it all is going to be adjusted. Those binoculars we are using at the moment to look at ourselves and creation, all of which really constitutes man, are out of focus, giving us a distorted view of what God has already done. We will have to, in due course, bring them into focus so that we can get a better view of this perfect creation. As we get nearer the glorious scene, we will even be able to discard the binoculars, that lens of mortal thinking, and look directly at God. But let us not forget, even now, although the view appears to be distorted, it isn't. Let us remember, in spite of everything, we are looking at God because of God's allness. Yes, we are looking at God. Don't forget that. There is nothing else to see. This view is your body. You can never lose it. As for the body being material, it is a well-known fact that the matter which formed your body 10 years ago is not the same matter of which it is constituted today. So if you really believe yourself to be a material body, you must be well distributed around the country by now. We have good reason to believe that everything we see, everything we are conscious of, is really our body. One description of man in Christian Science is universe. In Science and Health, answering the question, what are body and soul, Mrs. Eddy says, identity is the reflection of spirit. In some early editions of Science and Health, she used the word body, meaning identity. But this caused so much confusion among her students. So she changed the word body to identity. Generally speaking, We do identify people by their bodies, but this is not always reliable. For instance, my good wife is a twin. I mean one of twins. At one time, very few people could tell them apart. I was an exception, of course, but they could be identified by their different individualities, which had nothing to do with the size or shape of their bodies. In other words, man has an identity, body, but it is not material. This identity is, as Mrs. Eddy says, the reflection of spirit. She also says, Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals. This sinning mortal man is God misseen. A proper view of God reveals the real man to us as it did to Jesus. A Christian science lecturer once made the statement that God reveals himself as man. Jesus relied for his whole experience on his view of God. Under the marginal heading Reflection of Spirit in the textbook, Mrs. Eddy has written, "Soul is the substance, life and intelligence of man, which is individualized but not in matter. The moment you begin to think of your fellow man as God individualized, you will get a better view of him straight away." Then Mrs. Eddy follows up by saying, "Man is the expression of soul. Separated from man, who expresses soul, spirit would be a non-entity. Man, divorced from spirit, would lose his entity. You, me, everybody is God individualized. Only God expressed is God. God not expressed would not be God. The only God there can be is an active God, God expressing himself, omni-action God. Indeed, God is so bound up with activity that it would not be wrong to describe him as action. A dormant God could not be God, so God is expressing himself, and this God expresses himself by his idea, man. This process is perpetual, it could not stop. So we can't come to a stop. Perhaps we could only say that our true body is the natural outcome of the alignment of our thoughts with those of good. I would say that man's body is his consciousness of his oneness, his unity with God. So God and man are one, and no separation can take place. Man will never be without a body. This is a very good reason for claiming our inseparability from God. Man being God expressed, God knowing himself, how can God's knowing of himself be separated from God? The relationship is indissoluble, but one thing we must remember, Jesus never advocated trying to get rid of the present material sense of body. By his actions, he told us what to do about it. He always healed it when it needed healing. He always restored it to soundness in every respect. He never hinted at its destruction, but with love recommended the best care for it by right thinking. His last deed before his resurrection was to heal and restore his own body. We should never neglect our human sense of body. It is useful to us in our present stage of advancement, and the best concept we have at the moment. We will always have the same body, but our view of it will change as we advance spiritward. Subheading, God as Divinity. God is divine. More is wrapped up in Mrs. Eddy's use of that descriptive word divine than appears on the surface. I have never been able to find a dictionary definition of the word divine that has satisfied my sense of what it should really mean. thinking of divine as excellence in the highest degree does convey the idea. For instance, God cannot be compared to anything else at all, for he is all there is, and he is his own standard of excellence. For the same reason, I hesitate to speak of God as perfect. But if you do this, I would not say it was incorrect, for Mrs. Eddy does speak of perfect God and perfect man. However, would it not be better to speak of God as perfection? For here again, God is his own standard. By comparison, you could say that man is perfect, but God is the incomparable, all-inclusive God of eternity and infinity, who is himself that very excellence and perfection of his own creation. Well, he just is, and that is that. Subheading, God as Supreme. In her interpretation of the Lord's Prayer in the textbook, Mrs. Eddy asks that we be enabled to know, as in heaven, so on earth, God is omnipotent, supreme. Two dictionary definitions of the word supreme are holding power which cannot be overruled, and not exceeded by any other. But God doesn't hold power, he is power. And as for being exceeded by any other, although the world by its own actions today believes very much that evil has power which even exceeds that of God, do we? Many fondly believe that evil has more power and is more effective for bringing good into their lives than good itself can be. If they can make a quick profit by using underhanded business methods, especially if the trading competition is honest, then that appears to be all right. This is an example of a really confused mode of thought, using evil to bring good into one's experience. For all that money can buy is regarded as good. The writer of the book of Ecclesiastes says, "A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things." What muddled thinking that is! Although we may be fooled for a time, the moral law has never been outmoded, and evil can only produce evil. Here is the reverse of the meaning of the words used by Mrs. Eddy in her poem Mother's Evening Prayer, when she says, "And fear no ill, since God is good, and loss is gain." The quick profit is no gain, it is a dead loss. One's integrity is something which, if sold, cannot easily be bought back again, not in this world at least. To be trusted is something that money cannot buy. There really is no such thing as an honest man. The only man there is the image and likeness of God, and has no need to either be honest or dishonest, for he is complete, embodying with his own makeup all that he needs. He needs nothing to add to himself. He is the product of absolute integrity. God, good, turns out to be supreme in all walks of life. This is the end of part 1.